open the public hearing on House Bill 5052, and I will turn it over to our great LFO analyst here to make a report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to let you know that I've distributed a one-page sheet labeled Comparative Management Ratios.
Ooh, yeah.
In response to a question that Representative Smith had relating to the number of managers in this agency compared to numbers for other agencies of a similar size. And just to explain what this table is showing, the first column there represents the information for this agency, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and I just picked the three agencies that are the closest in size. So they have nothing other in common with this agency except that they have a similar number of employees. That first row shows the total number of employees in each of these four agencies. The second row shows the number of employees that are classified as executive service or as management service. And the, below that is the ratio. So, for example, for OSAC, there are 3.9 non-executive management employees for each executive or management service employee. The way that those ratios work is the higher the number, the less management heavy an agency is, and the lower the number, the greater or the more the management there is in that particular agency. At the bottom there, I just wanted to briefly show you what executive service and management service means, because these are terms that you may not hear very often. Executive service are those employees who are classified, a very limited set of employees that includes department heads, administrators, their deputies, their executive assistants, and certain principal assistants. So these are people who basically run the agency and have access to information that most of the agency employees would not have necessarily have information to, including personnel type of issues and things of that nature. Management service is another category that's more widespread. For example, at OSAC, there are five out of the 20 there that are listed as executive service or management service. Five of those are executive service, and the other 15 are management service. Management service employees are supervisory, confidential, or managerial employees. They are not part of a collective bargaining unit. The codes that I have in parentheses after executive service and management service are just the state codes that we use in the human resource system to categorize these employees. And the my main purpose for putting them here is to provide background information for anyone from these agencies who may get a hold of this and want to be able to confirm that my numbers were correct. Now, one thing to note is that not all management service or executive service employees actually manage or supervise other people, even though the name may make it appear that way. For example, if you look at the executive service list, you can see that the executive assistants to, say, the executive director is an executive service employee, even though typically that employee may not have specific management responsibilities over others. For management service, there are a lot of people who are classified as management service who really don't supervise anyone, but because of the nature of what they are doing, they are not... they do have access to information or to making policy decisions as to how to implement legislative directives, and they are classified as management even though they don't have supervisory positions. For example, in LFO, the people in my situation, we're all classified as management even though we don't supervise anyone. So if you take out the management people who are not supervising, and you look at the people who are actually supervising, that's that third row. I've listed there just the executive and management supervisors. And that would be a subset of the second row numbers. You can see for OSAC, there are actually 13 people who actually have responsibility for supervising other employees. So there are 6.5 employees on average for each supervisor. As you compare that with the other agencies listed here, you can see that falls within the range. That's more management than there is in the Bureau of Labor and Industries, where they actually have 7 employees per supervisor, but it is fewer than they would have in the Office of Energy or the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, where there are fewer people per supervisor. What this means is it's difficult to really evaluate this much further without knowing having more information about what these agencies are doing. I think that these kind of ratios are useful because if they really fall out of line, that certainly shows that there's something that requires, additional looking into.
Mm-hmm.
When something like this appears to be, an agency appears to be in line, it's hard to say specifically whether they have too many or too few managers or exactly the right amount. You have to look at more than just the ratio itself. But I think this exercise is helpful, and also I would point out that these are just 3 agencies we're comparing them to, and to get a better understanding, you really should look at a broader set. But we don't have time to do that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that a lot.
Questions or comments from the committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. A question about who is subject to collective bargaining. Are any of these positions listed under executive service excluded from collective bargaining?
My understanding is that they are all excluded.
They all are.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Further comments or questions? Let's take up where we left off.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was actually going to start off today with the budget summary and then have the agency move on to some of their detail.
Please.
So that is this document here. For the record, I'm Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services. Okay, if you go to page 2, you see the budget, the wall of numbers, budget summary. And I thought this was actually a good place to look at some of the detail, even though it's sort of hard to look at this table, because you can look at the changes as we've gone through the special sessions and then on to the governor's budget. So if you look at general fund, remember most of the general fund in this agency is for the opportunity grant. And you see in the 0103 column, close of session, they did have a considerable increase in funding as a result of the legislature adding $5 million additional dollars. Then through 5th special session, they're down to $36 million and lost about $3 million there. And then at governor's budget, down again to $34 million. Lottery funds, you also see going down. Part of that is simply a result of lower lottery earnings, lower interest rates, basically. Then at the governor's level, keep in mind that at the governor's level, we incorporated the effects of ballot measure 19, taking $150 million out of the Education Stability Fund, so that did reduce earnings out of that. These numbers do not yet incorporate the additional $112 million transfer out of the Stability Fund, and as Steve talked about on Monday, that will reduce lottery about another $2.5 million for 0305. And then if you skip down one line to federal funds, that's the other piece of the opportunity grant. The lottery and federal funds are completely for opportunity grant. And you do see the $1.4 million. Again, at the point of governor's budget, that included some loss of federal funding, about a half a million, 600,000, somewhere in there, as a result of maintenance effort issues. But as you heard, with the lower lottery revenue, if that ends up being the approved budget, they would lose all of the federal funding here. Then the other point I wanted to make, the other funds on the third line is other funds limited expenditure limitation. That is the private awards and the loan program, but the piece of those programs that are actually used to administer and run the programs in the agency. So those are personnel costs and those kind of costs. Whereas down on the fifth line, the other funds non-limited, that is actually the pass-through money as a result of those two programs. So it's actually the money from private scholarships that goes out to students, and it's the amounts that the agency uses to purchase defaulted loans. So that's actually pass-through program-type money. And you'll see on FTE in the governor's budget, there is a net increase of 5 positions, and we'll talk about those as we get into the policy packages. Okay, page 3 really just shows the same thing then graphically. You see about half their budget being the non-limited other funds. Okay, on page 4, overall, the governor's budget is a 4.7% increase from the 2003 through 5th special session. Major changes are there was an overall reduction to the opportunity grant of about $6 million through the special sessions, and that includes both reductions in general fund, a decline in lottery revenue, and some loss of federal funds. Major programs included in the governor's budget or opportunity grant is funded slightly below the 2003 through 5th special session level. That provides funding to our estimate at governor's budget was about 57% of eligible low-income students. Now, keep in mind that is based on the old eligibility criteria, and I know the agency will be talking more about this, but recently the commission did make a policy decision to lower the income criteria to focus this money to the most needy students. So as your criteria changes, so does that percentage of eligible served. In addition, there is new positions added in the governor's budget, both for workload in the loan and private awards programs and in the Aspire program, which we'll talk about in a little more detail. Okay. On page 5, you see the budget split up by program units, the grants and scholarships being the biggest part of the budget, 57%, including both the opportunity grant and the private scholarships in that program unit. And then the loan division being the most of the rest of the agency's budget, with small pieces for information technology support and administrative support, and then a little piece for the Office of Degree Authorization combined with some central policy and research functions. Page 6, the budget by budget categories, and again, as you'd expect, a lot of special payments, and that's all that non-limited funding going out for scholarships and loan defaults. Okay, page 7, a little bit of detail about how we built the governor's budget. Started with a legislatively adopted budget of $110 million total funds, or about $39 million general funds. Actions through April, or basically through second special session, there was a reduction to the opportunity grant of $2.2 million as a result of that declining lottery revenue. There were also smaller reductions in administration and in the foster youth scholarship program. Base budget adjustments are basically the roll-up of position and compensation actions. That's an increase of about $1 million total funds. In this agency, about 90% of their personnel costs are other funds, and about 10% is general fund. This included a net decrease of 3 full-time equivalent positions. Then on page 8, essential packages, this budget does include standard adjustments for inflation and state government service charges. I know you've heard in some of the biggest agencies we did remove inflation as we built the governor's budget, but for agencies that were already through our process, it was too late to go back. So I know that's one of the issues that you guys are looking at. There is an 050 fund shift package. We reduced the general fund because at that point lottery was actually growing faster than inflation, and so we substituted some lottery funding for general fund. Now, of course, the lottery will be lower, but the general fund's still not in there. policy packages, the 082 package, it includes the effect of the fifth special session reductions, the House Bill 5100 Section 1 cuts, a $3.3 million reduction to opportunity grant. Package 083 incorporates the effect of an October emergency board to get federal funds up to sort of current program levels, but then you'll see in 091 where we do the reductions piece, that comes back out, actually. 091 is the fifth special session reductions as a result of ballot measure 28 failing. So that eliminates $2.8 million general fund, the matching federal funds of $648,000, and a small increase in other funds. Basically, the general fund is a continuation of the pro rata reductions to the opportunity grant. And then we did cut one general fund position, but rather than eliminating the position, we moved it to other funds to meet workload demands in the private award scholarships program, which has been growing rapidly. So that means that person will be available to do workload in private awards, but not on the opportunity grant side. And then on page 9, we get into the sort of true policy packages. Package 100 is an organizational realignment. There's no net budget impact, but this package is moving some positions around in the agency. They have created this new policy and research section. Partly they're trying to adjust to changing workloads in different parts of the agency. Although it's sort of invisible in the package, they are also merged three sections in their loan program down to two sections. Package 201 is the Aspire program, which they've talked about, that puts the volunteer mentors into high schools. This adds $1.4 million other funds limitation and five positions. They currently have three people administering that program. One of them is a limited duration, which automatically gets removed from the budget as we rebuild it, and two of them are currently on a temporary basis. This would add permanent staffing. I just want to note here that all of this funding is dependent on grants, and some of them are, a couple of them are certain at this point, a number of them are still not certain, and we may have a little more certainty to some of that funding as we get to work session.
Can you give us an idea of what the timelines are on knowing for certain about the grants? I mean, is this something that we need to consider as we go into work session, or are we going to know by then?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think there's like five different grant streams and big pieces of the AmeriCorps grant. And I don't, well, do you have a sense of exactly when you'll know?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Sweetser, Executive Director. And the funding streams are not certain. And the way we set it up last time was the positions were approved last legislative session. They were approved subject to the agency being able to secure the financing. We have a plan out there that says if we secure these funds, we want to have regional coordinators throughout the state. If we are not successful, we will not be able to go into those areas. But so the quick answer is we may not have that information at the time that you pass this budget out of your committee.
Then on package 300, the loan program staffing adds 279,000 other funds in two positions. That's a marketing position and a trainer to provide technical assistance to schools participating in the loan guarantee program. The agency is proposing to use two recently vacated positions that they feel they don't really need to refill in their current functions in lieu of these two new positions. However, after discussion all around. We thought it probably makes more sense to leave the package in there to facilitate discussion of that whole issue. And I know you'll also be hitting it as you go through the vacant position lists and discussing those. And finally, package 400, database administrator, adds a position and $125,000 other funds to support the new in-house loan processing system and other workload issues. Oh, there is one more. Page 10, a small technical adjustment to the package 201, the Aspire program. The analyst inadvertently put the funding in the wrong category in the budget. So this is the AmeriCorps stipends, and we originally thought it was more it should be services and supplies as a contract sort of service, but after looking into it more closely, that these stipends actually, although they're not positions in the budget, they actually do run through the payroll system, so it would be more accurate to reflect those in personal services. No net budget impact. Thank you.
Questions or comments? Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out something. I think, I don't know what you guys think, but I think this is kind of complicated, and that's not a, Ms. Ames did an excellent job in explaining this, but I just wanted to point out something that as you look through these budgets, if you look at her presentation on page 8, I would ask you to focus specifically on two package numbers that you're going to keep seeing in all of these general fund budgets. And those are package 082 and package 091, because these are the packages that will tend to show the cuts that are being made in the budget because of the general fund shortfall. In every case, these packages will, you know, essentially be general fund cuts that are being made in order to help balance the budget this biennium. As you can see there, as Ms. Ames mentioned, there's about a $6 million cut combined in those two packages. And the method that was used to generate this amount of money, and the reason why it's $6 million and not $8 million or not $4 million, is that the actual cuts in 103, the current biennium, that were the result of Special Session 5, and that includes the fact that Measure 28 ended up failing, but those combined were about $3 million. And this number is essentially doubled. So the cuts that occurred this biennium because of what a rebalance of Special Session 5 occurred in the second year of the biennium. That's the timing of them. So what the governor did in the budget for this agency was take those one-year cuts, and since we're now budgeting for 2 years, basically those cuts were doubled with a small inflation factor of about 3.5%. You will find, as you look at these agents, you know, every time we have another education budget, we'll have to look again at 082 and 091 and see how they're calculated. And generally, in rough terms for the education budgets, the governor did this in pretty much the same manner. Whatever the cuts were in, because of Special Session 5, were generally doubled. That is not the case for all agencies, though. If you look at non-education agencies, in many cases, the cuts for Special Session 5 were increased by a factor of far more than double. So they might be tripled or quadrupled in some cases, or even higher in some cases. But for education, this was what was done. We'll also see that in some cases, there were cuts that were made early in the budget rebalance process, like in Special Session 2. That was a case that'll be particularly show up for higher ed. And you'll see there that the 082 and the 091 won't show the full story. But for this agency, this basically shows how the budget is being rebalanced. There are other things going on because of the lottery, and those are showing up elsewhere, and those are very important. But I would urge you, as you go through all of these in this subcommittee or any other subcommittees you serve on, to try to focus on 082 and 091. I think that'd be helpful to you.
That's very helpful.
Thank you.
Further comments or questions on the BAM presentation? Thank you very much.
Mr. Sweetser, I believe the ball's in your court now.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jeff Sweetser. I'm the Executive Director of the Student Assistance Commission. And I want to start at page 19 in your handouts that talks about major changes within the past 10 years. I'll also be taking a look at reviewing an admin division or administration division and information technology and talk about vacancies and affirmative action, and then we'll begin the divisional presentations. Real briefly, and at the risk of sounding like a broken record, this is something that you've heard a number of times. As far as the major changes, we have seen, actually my slide doesn't translate to what is on this PowerPoint, so I'm going to operate off of my slide. I think this is the same same information you have. We have a large increase in the number of Oregonians attempting to pursue an education. The Education Endowment Fund was created to assist in financing the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We've seen the loss of education endowment funds as a result of the creation of the Education Stability Fund. We've seen the numbers and dollar amounts in the private scholarship arena increase significantly. We entered into a partnership with the Oregon Community Foundation to invest donor monies to maximize the return on donor deposited funds. And we have increased our emphasis on customer service with the establishment of an outreach program. And we've also seen changes to the federal loan guarantee program. The next slide is controlling cost. And I think what I might have done is just loaded up the wrong PowerPoint presentation. So while we are fixing that, I wanted to just briefly talk about what we've done to control cost. We are we've gone through an agency reorganization. Linda indicated that we consolidated three of our loan divisions down to two. We freed up a management service position in that process. We have also consolidated our policy and research folks into one area, and we are also using increased technology to provide services, most significantly in the opportunity grant awarding and processing arena. We're just bringing online a scholarship electronic application, and we are providing information through a number of websites. Our most recent one is getcollegefunds.org. It's a tool for prospective students and current students to find out about how to access college, a list of resources that takes them to other websites. We have calculators in there to help them figure out how to go to college. Our main website. We also maintain a website for the Oregon Indian Coalition on Post-Secondary Education. And then we also are providing a web-based service for our schools that allows them to track students that attend more than one institution. And Oregon State University and Lynn Benton Community College were the pilot. They send us their students who are in attendance at their institution. We match them up for that and then feed that information back to them. And that's important to them because if they have a student who is taking three or four credits at one institution and six or ten at the other institution, the regulations regarding entitlement to federal benefits says if you're a full-time student, you get X number of dollars. And so by combining the total enrollment at both schools, they can see that they have a full-time student instead of a half-time student here and a half-time student at the other institution. So that is also a service that we provide. And then we have a new loan processing system that allows us to grow without significant increases in expenditures. Thank you. some of the steps that we've taken to control cost, we all mentioned the agency reorganization. We have expanded our finance division to improve control and management of the financial functions. We're relying fairly heavily on ACH payments that cuts down on the actual cost of delivering money to our recipients.
Sure.
We have...
One moment, please. Representative Bates.
Some of the acronyms you're using don't mean too much.
Oh.
What kind of payments were those?
Thank you. We love acronyms in this business. ACH is automated clearinghouse payments, and that it's through the Treasury, Oregon Treasury.
Follow-up?
Yeah, and so you receive monies from the Treasury?
No, we run all of our monies through Treasury as a state agency, and in lieu of generating a paper check and the number that I've heard is it cost about $25 to generate a paper check. With the automated clearinghouse payments, you're doing it electronically. We're talking into the pennies, 10 cents.
These are the checks you cut to the students?
Most of our aid goes to institutions who then deliver it to students.
What's the cost of... Are those institutions delivering those checks to the students? They have administrative overhead also that takes money out of it?
That is correct, and that's why we prefer to go the ACH route or the electronic funds route. So we send a database to Treasury, who then electronically takes money out of our account and electronically puts it into the school's account, and then by them having an electronic record, they can electronically allocate those dollars to their students' accounts as well. So it saves not only on our end, but at the institution's end as well.
Are you going to ask the inevitable question?
The inevitable question, I assume. Why don't you ask it, Madam Chair? Let's keep on the same track.
Yeah.
So there's administrative overhead at the state level to handle this money, and then you drop it into the accounts at the schools. And I assume somebody at those schools also has administrators looking at that money that then finally cuts a check to the student. Is that correct?
There is internal controls in each organization to ensure that the money is being placed where it should be. And I'm not sure that, it is much less expensive to administer this electronically than it is for us to generate paper checks.
I'm not concerned about the electronic transfer.
Okay.
I'm worried about or concerned about, as we see over and over in all budgets, layers and layers of administration between the money the taxpayers pay into the system and where it gets to when the recipient actually gets to get to access that money.
And if I might further just clarify, each layer that money passes through takes a chunk of it out to cover the costs of them doing whatever they do to it. And that's one of the things that we're paying a great deal of attention to this time, is trying to streamline the money going straight to where the services are provided to keep as many straws out of it as possible.
And to follow up, Madam Chair, a lot of it is very untraceable. For instance, the administrative cost at the school level is probably not directly shown when you pass the money through, but it's the cost the students pay to go to school there. So their tuition and the cost of that school are wrapped into the administrative cost of these loans coming through. Whether or not making a direct payment to a student and giving them a voucher type of system right from the state level would reduce cost at the schools, the other question. But my guess is there is a cost for passing out through the school system, and the problem is finding that cost, because they're not going to show it in their books directly as a cost against that loan. But somebody, an administrator, is sitting there sucking up the dollars, and I imagine most of it goes straight through and no one ever questions it.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, there is an administrative cost in this process, and I think there, no matter what method you use, there is, you want some oversight. You want to be able to ask somebody, what did you do with the money? Where did it go? And whether it's a voucher plan or whether it is as it is currently administered, you will have some overhead costs because you want accountability. And with the just to beat this dead horse, with the ACH, it is significantly reduced the amount of administrative costs associated with delivering those dollars to students. I think that that is a good discussion about how best to allocate these dollars and most efficiently allocate them. And I think the other factor that comes into play is that you have, we represent students. We don't represent institutions or staff at institutions. We want the dollars to go to students, and that's our focus. But the most efficient way to do that is to give it to the schools who have student accounts set up at each institution to make sure it gets there.
The question I would ask is there a way, or is it even technologically possible for your agency to transfer money directly into the student accounts and bypass the need for the institutions to perform any functions at all on it?
If you are speaking of like a student's individual checking account, that is a possibility, but I think that would probably be more expensive than sending the money to an institution who has a standard account set up for each student on their campus. And so when the money comes in electronically that says Johnny receives X number of dollars and the Social Security number, they get to put it in directly into the account. Very efficient. If we have to do that for the 30,000 opportunity grant recipients, we're talking about 30,000 bank transactions or bank accounts, and you're going to have students who are closing their accounts. The money is going to bounce up against a non-existent account. We're going to have a lot of administrative back end in trying to get that money to Johnny when Johnny's going to have to set up a checking account, which he or she may not have.
I'm not sure. Maybe a better way to go about trying to figure this thing out is to ask the question about whether there's any way to ascertain how much of the money is disappearing after it leaves your shop and gets into the students' hands. Is there any way of ascertaining that amount?
Actually, every dollar that we send out is to a student. It's 100%. There is no administrative fee that the institution takes as a result of that payment. So if we send them $1,000, Johnny or Susie gets $1,000 put into their account, and it's not $950. Now, there are some operating costs that are included in that particular school's overall budget that I don't know as you can get to that trail. And I'm not sure that there's a direct trail.
What is the source of those operating funds?
For a school, it's tuition. If it's a state institution, state support. It's foundation money.
So there is, what I hear you saying then, just to make this clear in my mind, that in the amount of money that you allocate for student support through grants, none of that money goes to pay operational expenses. The operational expenses come out of somewhere else. Is that correct?
That would be my understanding. But I think in the final analysis, an institution has expenses and they have revenue, of which student aid is a part of their revenue stream. And I think it's somewhere at the bottom of this conversation or the nth degree, somehow, somewhere, some of that money is going to go to support the operation of the organization. But there isn't a direct relationship or a direct connection.
Madam Chair?
Back to you.
Madam Chair and I sometimes play tennis in this thing, you know.
I used to play racquetball.
Yeah, that's too hard.
I said I used to.
Oh, okay. Let me go at this a little different way. Obviously, when the money comes down to the institutions, they've got built-in overhead, and they don't track specifically what the overhead is for handling these loans. And I understand that's what you're telling me. Is that correct?
Correct.
And
that's
real,
my understanding.
Yeah, and that would be reasonable. Sure. I mean, they're not going to say we have a line item. We're, you know, we have these many FTEs looking at the money coming through and handling the program for us. It's part of their overall package, and there's overhead to it. And most of the over, it looks to me, sounds to me like most of the oversight occurs where it should occur, which is at the institutional level. They know if those students are enrolled. They know if they're going to classes. I mean, basically, I run this program every month at my house. I write a check to my daughter at U of O, okay? And I do a little oversight now and then. You know, I get a report card and ask this where you were last weekend, and, you know, and how come there's this, you know, what were you doing at 7-Eleven, you know, at 3 in the morning with my card, you know? So, I mean, those things happen. So I run the program. What I might have difficulty with here is looking at from the other direction of why we seem to be doing some duplication of effort. And what I'm thinking is your organization is trying to cut checks to students through the people who are really doing the oversight. The question I'd ask you is, why do you not just eliminate that process and cut checks to the institution on a block grant basis and let them do the job they're already doing, and maybe we can eliminate a couple of $1 million of overhead in your agency? We wouldn't need as many FTEs, I wouldn't think, if we weren't trying to track individual students and money was flowing directly to the institutions to do the oversight, and maybe then more money would get to students. That means a turf problem for you guys.
Actually, Madam Chair and Representative Bates, we, in essence, do something like that right now. We provide money to the institution based upon their historical usage of the opportunity grant. We provide them sums of money that we then account for as we go through this process, as we go through the year. And if it looks like they are not spending as much, then we don't, and we do this on a quarterly basis or semester basis with a final reconciliation at the end of the year. We allow the school to, in essence, really manage those funds. And based upon historical experience and what their populations look like currently, we will send them sums of money, and if it's not enough, they call us up and we send them additional sums. And at the end of the year, we say, okay, give us all the Johnnies and Susies at your institution and how much you delivered and what our, and we reconcile our records to make sure that we have 100% accountability in the program. So we do something like that today in the Opportunity Grant program. And I think that maybe the question is, what do you get by having it at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission? You get a commission who is focused on serving students regardless of what institution that they go, who takes a look at the overall policy implications of the Opportunity Grant. You have one central place where those decisions are being made. If you did not have that, then you have either the legislature makes those decisions or institutions are making those decisions. And I just think that we're a knowledgeable body to house those types of decisions for. The legislature. We are your staff in this area.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. The slide that we're looking at now is focused on controlling costs and implementing efficiencies. Mm-hmm. And with that said, I need more information about the marketing program and the marketing position that's being added. Why do you need that function? Is that a function that could be handled differently through the and at the institutions, for example?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, the marketing position is in our loan program. We have any number of schools that are participating in the program, and it is it's a competitive environment. We are competing with other national guarantors as far as providing services. So our goal is to use that position to make sure our customers understand of what we bring to the equation for them, not only in loans but in private scholarships and opportunity grant, information outreach, like through the Aspire program. So it's a communications position.
The total cost, Madam Chair, of the marketing aspect of the program is what?
I'm just looking at the materials that Linda prepared. I don't have that in front of me. I think it was $279,000 for the biennium.
And that's the total marketing program.
And that's an outreach position. That's a training position. So to give you an example, yesterday this individual was responsible for holding a school advisory meeting. We call in schools and we seek their advice about how best to improve what it is that we do to meet their needs. So when I say marketing, it's also outreach, it's communications, it's getting as close to our customers as possible to understand what their needs are and for us to fill that need. And the training position is an integral part of that as well. We may go out and provide them training on our loan system. We may go out there and train them on federal regulations, federal processes. So it's a way of serving our customers, and they don't have resources or staff. And by having a trainer on our staff, we can most efficiently deliver that out into the community.
Madam Chair, I'm just, thank you, wondering out loud what would happen if that function were to go away and the funds captured and used for scholarships. How would the agency adjust?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, those positions are all other funds, and they're funded through the Federal Family Education Loan Program. And the requirements of that program require that the funds that are generated in that program be used for that program purpose. So we are not able to just move those into opportunity grants or scholarships, where the federal laws preclude that.
The funds must be used for marketing?
They must be used for program purposes.
Other than marketing?
Marketing, training, technical assistance, those all come under program.
Okay. Just trying to better understand.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure.
Have we got further questions or comments? Please proceed.
The last item of proactive steps taken was the Aspire program, and we'll get into talking about that when we get into the Grants and Scholarships Division. We were asked to comment on the coordination that we do with other agencies. I'm not really going to read through this list. You can glance through that. If you have some questions, I'll be happy to answer those. The next slide is administrative versus program cost. And this is kind of getting to what we were talking about earlier, that our administrative costs compared to program costs have been in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%. And if you look at 2003-2005, it is about 0.6% higher. And part of that, most of that, is in the reorganization that we were talking about. We're moving some the outreach, the training positions into the administration division instead of having them decentralized out into the organization. So the dollars were in one place being treated as operational program expenses. Now they are being treated as administrative expenses.
Can I ask a kind of a global question here? Looking at this spreadsheet, administrative versus program costs, in 03-05 you're slated to have a pretty hefty increase in the percentage of program costs. Is there a potential in that, for instance, the grant that you're applying from the federal government to do the outreach, to
actually redirect that money at this point? Or in the grant application, if you get the grant, are you bound to spend the money in the way that you applied for? And where I'm coming from here is I'm curious if there are, rather than doing outreach with the money, if there could be a way to use it to offset some of the administrative costs in other areas that would result in a net increase of fungible dollars going into the awards side of the program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have the specifics of the grant request that we have, but my recollection is that when we applied for that grant, we lay out what those costs, what we're asking for is going to cover, and the grants are very specific about how you use that money. So I don't have the specifics. I'd have to take a look at that and see. But my sense is that we probably are not in a position to do that. I'm going to just briefly talk about information technology. We use two systems, an in-house AS400, and then we also have a loan system. The next page, if there are any questions, just interrupt me. Otherwise, I'm going to move very quickly through this. IT interfaces with others. There's a list of all the organizations that we, it's probably not all, but a majority of the institutions and organizations that we communicate with and exchange information. I'm on page slide 26. As I stated, we have two main systems. The next slide, question about upgrades and services. We have no plans for any hardware upgrades in 03-05, and we will continue to improve our software applications. Next question was about monitoring and review.
Can I ask a question on, you have a policy package here that allows you to develop an in-house loan processing system. Mm-hmm. When have you done an RFI or an RFP process to see if there are ways to outsource that development rather than having it done in-house?
Actually, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we already have the system. I think this statement here is that we just completed an electronic application for our scholarship program. We're just fine-tuning our software as we go along. This is in-house improvements.
Oh, so this isn't a software purchase. You're just tweaking things.
Going forward, that is correct.
And so the administrator that you would hire or that you would propose to hire under Policy Package 400,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
The explanation says support new in-house loan processing system and address workload issues.
That's correct. And I'm going back to slide 26. We purchased the software for an electronic student loan processing system in 2002, and it is a database-driven system. We don't have a database administrator. It's highly complex, very technical, and while we have staff in-house who are currently providing that service, we rely heavily on the software provider, and that isn't a part of the agreement. So we need to bring staff up to speed in order to be able to fully manage that software.
And what is the purpose of the database? What does it do?
I'm sorry, excuse me?
What does the database do?
It houses all of the student loan records. So if we receive an electronic application for a loan, the system keeps track of all of the individual data. It also manages information for federal reporting purposes. It allows students to access the system and determine where their loans are at. We provide information to schools and lenders that loans are being guaranteed. So it's keeping track of a lot of pieces of information on every student globally.
Is there a comparable system that operates on the individual campuses? I mean, how do they track where students are at in terms of their loans?
schools, Madam Chair and members of the committee, schools have systems as well, and they import information from our systems to populate their databases. Their school databases cover not only student loans, but they are participating in the Pell Grant program. Most of them are. They also have their institutional scholarship information. Theirs is it's a student. Well, I'm not really sure what they all have, but student loans are a part of the information that they would have in their database, but they would not have the depth of information that we would have on a particular loan that their student took out.
But because they also provide financial assistance, they have to have some kind of a function that tracks their piece of it, too.
That's correct. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's really at a higher level. The fact that a student has applied for a loan and they're expecting a disbursement of $1,000, that it came in on this date and was deposited into their account. So it's more for the school, the financial aid piece, it's more of a tracking, current tracking of current aid for a student. They also have other responsibilities like making sure the student has maintained satisfactory academic progress so that they're meeting the eligibility requirements. So they have other responsibilities.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
So if a student, it's like you have two different databases going on, one at the school and one at your level, mm-hmm. and the school is concerned about is the student enrolled, are they completing their courses, or are they being a responsible student and getting through, plus they may have private scholarships money that you'd be unaware of that the school mm-hmm. can award, mm-hmm. correct?
Correct.
And they can come to you for certain types of funds, or an opportunity grant, and some guaranteeing of loans, mm-hmm. and some federal programs that might be woven into that. Mm-hmm. So you have these two overlapping systems, it sounds like to me. Am I getting the correct picture?
There is some overlap. There are two distinct functions.
No, not 100% overlap, but there's some overlap between the two of them, two circles that don't completely overlap. I just have conceptually a hard time why one group doesn't take it over or the other group take it over, and why you have two overlapping systems that seems to me to raise overhead.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, I believe it's because they serve two different functions. That one is the school, it's really an accounts receivable system from the financial piece, as I see it, is they're going to put it on the books that the student owes them tuition. And it's going to hang out there until money comes in. So when they receive information from us that the student qualifies for an opportunity grant, they credit that student's account. It's a really an accounts receivable system. But it is just a part of all of their other processes that they administer, not only in the financial aid office, but in admissions and registrars. So these are very complex systems, and for one to take over the other, I'm not sure that it's kind of like a world domination kind of a thing. I don't think that if you try to sum it all together and put it into one huge package, I'm not sure it would work very well.
I have a question. Is there an interactivity between the dollars that are awarded through the scholarships and financial aid that are specific to the campuses and the dollars that the Student Assistance Commission awards? Is there an interactivity there so that you know the total size of the support that an individual student is getting?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, no, we do not. That is an institutional focus. And I might add, when it comes to, this is an aside, but when it comes to our scholarship development, we look at donors who are interested in other than a single institution focus. If we have a donor who comes to us and says, I want to set up a scholarship at the University of Oregon, we say, you know what, let's put you in touch with their development, their foundation, so that they can handle that. We're not in the business of competing against the foundations out there that have a single donor, a single institution focus. But if we have a donor like the Ford Foundation who wants to serve a good number of students at Oregon institutions, then we do want that responsibility because we receive federal data that allows us to efficiently put together award materials for committees to review. So I got off track there, so bring me back.
Okay, so here an example is if you have a student that is going to the University of Oregon and that student receives some kind of a athletic scholarship, that would be, I assume, awarded at the campus level.
That is correct.
Then you would get an application from that student for an opportunity grant. And if that student was within the eligibility box that you'd set up for that budget period and fell into the opportunity grant, then you would never know that that student got some kind of athletic scholarship that paid, I don't know, say their whole way through college, and you would award them an opportunity grant as well. Is that true?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the statement is true, but I would just add that institutions have a responsibility to make sure that students are not over-awarded. So if they find themselves in a situation where the cost of education is $14,000 and they have aid that totals $20,000, they don't give a student $20,000. They only give them what it takes to cover their cost of education. And unfortunately, that's an unusual situation where a student has a full package. And as we get into talking about our budget report study, there's a gap. There isn't enough to cover the full cost of education. But we do not see all of the aid, but the institution is responsible for making sure a student receives no more than the cost of education.
Thank you. Further questions? Please proceed.
I'm going to just go through this, just briefly talk about OSAC administration. We have 11 employees in administration. 1.69 of those are paid by general funds. 9.31 are other funds. We have no budget-related policy legislation other than this, our budget bill. And I want to now talk about affirmative action. And this is a slide. I'm on page 32. And bring your attention to two columns. One is the last column, which is minority employees that we're either under or over as of February 2003, and it's broken out by classifications that the state tracks in affirmative action, and each of those shows whether we are a positive number is that we're over, a negative number is that we're under. There are three of those that we're under on. One is 0.1, another one is 1, another one is 0.9. So of the eight, three of the eight are under, and overall we are 0.11 under minorities. And that is an improvement over the past, and I had some notes here, but I don't have those in front of me. And I can provide you some historical perspective as well, if you'd like. And then under female goal, under and over utilization, we are pretty much over our goals there. Agency-wide, we're at 16.19 over goal. And then the other category is disabled, and we are over the state's goals by 2.54. But my notes do say that we have improved in people of color, middle management, and overall disabled. I will say that we have reached out to the University of Oregon, Lane Community College. We've also gone to Lane County Human Resources and the City of Eugene Human Resources, and just establish some connections as far as brainstorming, awareness, and just to open ourselves up to how do we make sure that we're doing what we can in making sure we're a diverse organization. Then we also serve our customers in affirmative action in a diverse population through our Aspire program. It is we're at Marshall, we're in Coos Bay, we're all over the state, and a lot of these schools have a very diverse population. And then our grants, opportunity grant.
Senator Gordley, you look like you're interested in asking questions.
Yes, I have several. I'm just trying to boil them
all
into
right.
One. How would you describe your efforts, and is there a plan to move more aggressively to add diversity to your agency? Because while there has been improvement, you're still underutilizing certain groups. So is there a plan with timelines, and how aggressive are your efforts? What assurances can you give us that we'll be looking at different numbers the next time around?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, there is no definitive plan. There's no hard timelines. Part of the situation we find ourselves in, and I'm not making any excuses, we don't have a lot of turnover in our organization. So if you don't have a vacant position to recruit to, there isn't that opportunity. But I will say that I think that our progress has been significant since the last time we reported on this, and I wish I had the historical comparative information, and I'd be happy to get that to you and sit down and have a conversation with you. But we are open to being a diverse organization, and here I'm a white, middle-aged male making that statement, but this is an area where I think that we have made good progress and will continue to make every effort to continue that good progress. I'd be happy to have a conversation with you about that as well.
Well, I accept your statement.
Okay.
For the record.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Sure. This is a continuation of the affirmative action, and just a summary of what I was saying earlier. One of the areas that to cover is vacancies. Linda alluded to some of those. In the Grants and Scholarship Division, we have two. One's an OS2 that is 100% other funds, and our recruitment is underway. We have an AS1 position that is 100% other funds, and I believe that was the one that was predominantly general fund, and in the budget balancing piece, we gave up the general fund with the understanding that we would be able to fill that with using all other funds. And we've just seen.
And can you talk to us about the source of the other funds for these two positions?
Yes, those would be from our private scholarship administration. It's to administer the.
Exclusively?
I would say probably not. There are other responsibilities that we have. We have they may assist in the Aspire program. There are we administer some programs like the Robert Byrd, which is a federal program which we receive no administrative support. We administer nursing services, which is a general-funded program with no administrative support. So it's using the positions as the need arises. So I would say probably not.
Is it possible to get the committee, with reference to these positions, a breakdown on the revenue sources that are going to go into funding them?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will look into that. I'm pretty sure it's all funded through private scholarship revenues, but I will look into that and report back. In the loan program, we have three vacant positions. RA is for revenue agent, and we are in the process of starting a recruitment to fill that position. Another revenue agent position is currently vacant, and we also have an OS2, Office Specialist 2 position that Linda was indicating in the program option package that we would use these positions in lieu of that program option package.
And did you have a question? With reference to the loan program, talk to us about whether there is an administrative component to the funding that you receive through this stream, and just kind of give us an idea of how that works.
There is an administrative component. The Federal Student Loan Program allows the agencies can use the revenues that are received from that for the overall administration of the program. So that would include direct operational costs like guaranteeing a loan or talking to a borrower and helping them default. It also provides for administrative money, which in my position, I am 80% funded by the loan program. It helps pay for our HR director. We have information technology folks who support that program. So, yes, it does provide for administrative monies that are directed at operating the program.
And is there a cap on what is allowed to be used for administration?
Yes, and it's through a cost allocation plan. We have to periodically, in fact, we're doing it right now, is track our time to determine how much time we are spending in each of the respective areas of the work that we do. So at the end of the day, I'll say, like today, I spent 2 hours in front of the legislature. It's a general fund activity, but I may spend the balance of my day working in the loan program. So I just keep track of that for 90 days, and then we add up all the numbers, and that's our cost allocation plan that we use to determine how much to charge to each program.
But surely there must be some outer edge at which they're going to say, no, you can't use 20% of the revenue from this program to fund your administrative function.
Madam Chair, we will get into that when we start talking about the audits, because that is exactly what happened to us. We pushed the envelope on using loan program monies to fund, to pay for a lot of the services that we provide. And they came back and they said, you're too aggressive. So,
please proceed.
Okay. That really concludes my piece. The next slide really talks about the budget units, and the first division that we'll be presenting is the Office of Degree Authorization. That is Alan Contreras.
Mr. Contreras.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan Contreras. I am the administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. I am also the director of the very small Policy and Research Division. I have two functions within the agency. I'm going to spend most of my time on Office of Degree Authorization because I think it requires the most explanation. I'm going to begin by going back to a question that was asked on Monday by both Senator Messerly and, I believe, by Representative Smith, about why the Office of Degree Authorization is attached to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission at all, why it is not part of the Department of Higher Education or the Department of Education. There are really two reasons for that. The most important is that one of ODA's functions that I will mention a little later on is to mediate and, if necessary, pass on to the Commission for decision disputes between colleges that are in different sectors. For example, if there is a dispute over who gets to offer a new degree program between the community colleges and a private provider in Portland, say, you couldn't really have that function assigned to the Department of Education because the Department of Education is not a neutral party. The community colleges are part of their operation. this function was assigned to OSAC because OSAC is the only higher education-related agency in Oregon that does not operate colleges, is not involved in having its own. It's a neutral agency. Now, the other reason is that ODA is responsible for approving new programs in Oregon from colleges that come from somewhere else or that are new startups in Oregon. For example, University of Phoenix is a college from somewhere else. Gutenberg here in Eugene is a small Great Books college. It's a startup. We are, in effect, responsible for signing off on programs that compete directly with the institutions that operate under those other two agencies. So it's really a conflict of interest provision related in ODA being assigned where it is. And if I have a chance to catch up with Senator Messerly, I will mention that to him. He was very interested in that issue. And that's why it is set up the way it is. The Office of Degree Authorization does four things. The major things we do are, first, enforce the law in Oregon against the use of diploma mill degrees, also fake degrees, fake diplomas. We are the investigating unit and the screening unit in state government that does that kind of thing. We do that partly through our own investigations and partly to response from inquiries from elsewhere. We had, I think, about 190 outside inquiries last year. The exact numbers are later on in the presentation. I won't take time with those. About 42% of those are from the private sector, private corporations, private individuals. They want to know if this degree is any good. We have the resources in-house in our agency, in ODA, to give them the answer to that question. Likewise, we get inquiries a lot from public agencies. We do a lot of screening for the employment department. We do some for the Board of Nursing, the Board of Psychologist Examiners, Counseling Examiners, things like that. We do a lot more of this now with foreign degrees than we used to because there are more people wanting to use a degree earned in a foreign country in Oregon. So we are the central source for that kind of information because most agencies, public and private, don't have those kind of resources in-house, and that's what we do. So that is our largest general fund supported activity. Our other general fund supported activities, which are set forth on I think on 41, involve the dispute resolution, which is sometimes called adverse impact, that I mentioned earlier, and also a small amount of work on gathering data related to higher education in Oregon. For example, we have the data regarding completion rates by degree type across the state. We also gather information about where Oregon high school graduates go to college in state. So those are our general fund supported activities. Our other major activity, which is supported entirely with applicant fees, is to evaluate programs for colleges that want to start up in Oregon, new ones, schools from somewhere else, that kind of thing. There's no general fund involved in that, and that is probably the single largest activity that we do. The Office of Degree Authorization consists of about 1.5 FTE when you add it all up for those functions. Most of the one is me, and we have an additional reviewer and some clerical support.
So might I just interrupt here? Am I correct in concluding that the bulk of your general fund goes into checking out the quality of the degrees that people have for employers?
It's for employers, and it's also for a lot of the individuals themselves. We get a lot of contacts from an individual who says, I have a degree from such and such a school. Can I use that in Oregon? Or I would like to attend such and such a school. Is it accredited? Can I use that degree in Oregon? Because Oregon doesn't allow the use of diploma mill degrees here. So those are the kind of inquiries we get.
Have you or has the commission had any discussion about having that be a fee-driven activity rather than a general funded activity?
We have not had that discussion in part because almost half of those inquiries come from public agencies. In other words, I suppose we could charge the State Employment Department every time they ask us for that kind of information, I don't know that that's a net gain to the public. It would be conceivable for us to charge, you know, a private employer. The problem that we face is that because ODA has a statutory duty to enforce a law against the use of diploma mill degrees, when we come across something like that, we have an obligation to act. In other words, I can't charge somebody who's breaking the law a fee when I send them a cease and desist letter and then go through that procedure. So I think the only possibility conceivably would be to charge private employers a fee for that kind of screening service. Otherwise, I don't think you get anywhere. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm kind of confused because I thought I heard you say that the bulk of what you check here is for people that actually hold the degrees to find out whether they're worth something. But maybe I'm not getting a clear picture of what's going on here. I don't understand how the Department of Employment got introduced into this discussion.
Because a lot of the requests that we get for screening come from the employer. It may involve an individual's use of a degree. But, for example, we would get a call from a state agency saying, we have an applicant who's going into this pool who has a degree from such and such a college that we've never heard of. It's in Russia. It's in Australia. It's in Alabama, but it's not on the accredited list. We would then help them figure out whether that school was any good or not. It does involve the use of degrees by individuals, but a lot of the requests that we actually receive do not come from the individual person. They come from someone who either does employ them, would like to employ them, wishes they hadn't employed them, and is trying to figure out if they're, you know, there are all sorts of scenarios. And then we do get questions from individuals, but what they want to know is, you know, what are the circumstances under which they could legally use a degree in Oregon.
So ultimately you are generally dealing with private employers or government employers? Is that what you're really dealing with here?
I did a very careful tracking all of the year 2002. We determined that 42% of our requests for assistance came from somewhere in the private sector. 42% came from public agencies, and the remainder came from colleges and universities, some of which were public, some of which were private. So it's really very widespread.
I would submit to you that there is the grounds here to have a discussion around a fee-for-service kind of an approach to funding this. And given the environment that we're in this time with general fund, what we have to do is justify spending general fund in this area rather than on spending it to services to disabled and elderly and medically needy and those kinds of people. And that in this particular situation, it seems like this is a service that the people that benefit from the service could pay for if they required it.
Madam Chair, I think we could do that with the private entities that contact us if our authorization statute permitted us to do so. It currently does not. We are allowed to charge fees for the applicant schools that want to operate in Oregon. That entire portion of our activity is fee-supported right now. But that wouldn't help with the requests we get from state agencies or school districts or counties or something. I mean, we could charge them, but it's the public charging the public in one form or another.
Yeah, and I think that we have also looked at numerous situations where when we put an internal charge in place for services that there is a corresponding decline in the number of requests for services that you get to because there's a consequence to asking for it. But if I could, Mr. Bender, have this introduced as a discussion item for work session on this budget.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Can I ask a few questions, please?
Yeah.
Does ODA actually accredit public and private institutions?
We do not accredit. Our process is an approval process that is program specific. In other words, if we approve a school to offer a degree in accounting, let's say the University of Phoenix wants to offer that degree in Oregon, that degree is approved. If they want to come in at some future time and offer a degree In medical technology, they have to get that degree approved also. We do not accredit schools. We approve specific programs for operation in Oregon. And startup schools, of course, brand new schools.
A follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
You say you approve but don't accredit. When you approve a new school, you do not accredit that school? I mean, we're sort of semantics here. I want to try to find out what you're really doing.
It's a word we carefully avoid using because the word accreditation has a generally accepted meaning across the country and elsewhere in Oregon law, which is that accreditation means that it is by an accrediting body that is recognized for that purpose by the U.S. Department of Education, the Northwest Association, the American Medical Association, groups that have a formal approval from the federal government to accredit. It's a term of art, and we don't use it for that reason. It just confuses people.
Who gives, so we say, approval then for K-12 schools?
I believe that's handled through the Oregon Department of Education, and some of the private schools I don't think require approval, but I'm way out of my depth in K-12. I never work with K-12. I only work with degree granters.
Madam Chair, if the Department of Education is a branch of public education but has oversight over private education, I don't follow the argument that you shouldn't be in the Department of Education. I just think it's a strange place for you to be. I just don't buy the process. You just suggested that it's conflict of interest if the Oregon Department of Education is doing private oversight in K-12. I don't know if they are or not.
Let me try to explain that one little problem again because it comes up all the time. One of the things that ODA is charged to do under the statute is serve as a mediator between schools that come from different sectors. Under Oregon law, a public institution that wants to start a new degree program has to announce that publicly. Private institutions from other sectors, have a statutory right to object on the grounds of detrimental duplication, that it's unnecessary to spend the public funds to do this, and so on. The entity that manages the communication and mediation process is my office. The problem with putting my office in the Department of Education is that the Board of Education, which would end up having to make those decisions, and if you moved it over there, is responsible for the community colleges, and the great bulk of adverse impact issues that come up, even though they're mostly resolved quickly, come as a result of conflict between the community colleges and private career schools and private providers. So you would have the board that actually is responsible for funding and overseeing the community colleges being asked to serve also in a neutral capacity as a mediator, arbitrator, to decide whether the competition for the community colleges gets to operate a degree program where the community colleges do. It's a conflict of interest situation. They would end up wearing two hats that the legislature has decided that they shouldn't do. If we didn't have that function, I don't think it would be a big problem, and in many states it is set up that way.
Madam Chair, I'd like to debate this today. I have problems with this, okay?
Okay.
You're getting general funds and trying to be neutral. You probably are neutral. The State Board of Education is supposed to be neutral in all these issues, too, just because they're overseeing part of the budget for public education. I'm not sure that they are not a more neutral source. So I'm not sure I buy your argument completely. We'll move on.
This is the structure within which I work today. So
this is an issue that came up.
I think I've covered the main functions of ODA and what we do. I will mention that our workload has increased a lot in recent years because a lot more schools have wanted to operate in Oregon. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University has come into Oregon. There have been others that have as well. But every time our workload goes up, the fee revenue goes up to cover that, so we have not ever had a need for general fund to deal with that situation. The other main function that I perform is as administrator of is as the director of the Policy and Research Division, and I will just mention that very quickly and move on. couple of years ago, the commission decided that rather than having certain research people scattered out through the agency, it would make more sense to assemble them in one place because their duties may need to shift from time to time depending on the needs of the agency. Those folks are assigned to me. They are funded almost entirely out of other funds, mostly out of the loan program. And I'm actually not going to spend any more time on that unit unless you have particular questions about what it does. The only significant increase in my portions of the agency budget this time around have to do with an increase from risk management, which is a consequence of ongoing litigation, which is something the agency does not have any control over. I really don't have anything else to present to you today, but I'd be glad to answer any other questions that you might have about the functions of the unit.
Questions? Thank you. I believe we have Kat Corden as our next presenter. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Kathy Corden, and I'm the Director of Guarantee Services and Default Prevention for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And today I'd like to give you an overview of the Federal Family Education Loan Program. And in your presentation notebooks, there's a section on the loan division, and I'm going to cover a couple of areas in that portion of your handbook. I'm going to start out with slide 62, but it's also this chart over here to my right. I'm going to concentrate on the loan division, which is the section in green. And just to give you an overview of what I'm going to cover, I'm going to start out with the, our budget and the makeup of the loan program. I'm also going to go through our different revenue streams that fund our program. I'm going to go over our loan division goals and how those relate to our performance measures, and then our accomplishments and what we want to accomplish in 0305. To give you a little bit of background on the FELP program, it has been administered by OSAC for the last 36 years. Our operational budget is $10 million, and that accounts for personal service and service and supplies for 19 full-time employees in the Guarantee Services and Default Prevention Division and 33.17 FTE in claims and collections. Additionally, you'll see a line item on here for loan payments and transfers for approximately $33 million. This is a non-limited projection of what we anticipate for 0305 as requests from lenders for reimbursements on claims. And generally, our requests for purchase of loans are for loans that are more than 270 days delinquent. However, we do purchase claims under other circumstances, such as the death or disability of a borrower would be an example. I wanted to note that our approximately 52 full-time employees are 100% other funded. And some of the services that we provide include new loan guarantees, servicing of those loans after they had been guaranteed, default prevention efforts, and then collection efforts if those loans do indeed default. On page 74, there's an outline of our revenue streams for this program. And our primary revenue streams are from originating loan guarantees, maintaining loans, and fees for default aversion efforts, and then collection fees also. And I'm prepared to go into detail on each one of those revenue streams if you prefer, or I can go ahead and go into our goals and how those relate to our performance measures.
We would be very interested in getting some background on how this all gets woven together.
Absolutely. Under origination fees, there are two sources for that. There's a loan processing fee, which is 1% of the loan amount that's guaranteed. This is a charge to the borrower. OSAC has opted to waive this fee since 1999. by waiving this fee, it allows additional dollars to remain at the student's disposal to pay for their educational costs. It is something that the commission reviews on an annual basis to determine if we are going to waive it each academic year. The other origination fee that we receive is a loan processing issuance fee. It's 0.4% of the new loan amount that's guaranteed, and it is paid to us by the Department of Education. This fee helps us to defray costs, administrative costs of guaranteeing the loan.
The loan issuance fee goes to the Department of Education?
It's paid to us from the Department of Education.
The U.S. from?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, U.S. Department of Education.
State or U.S.?
U.S., excuse me.
Okay, from the U.S. Department of Education to you to cover the cost of what?
Administrative costs for guaranteeing the loan.
Okay.
Is it 0.04%?
0.4%.
Go ahead.
We also receive a maintenance fee for servicing the loans after they've been guaranteed. That fee is 0.1%. of outstanding loans that are guaranteed. Again, that is paid to OSAC by the U.S. Department of Education, and that fee helps defray the costs of maintaining those loans after the loan has been guaranteed.
So if you roll these fees together, and can you just add them up and get the percentage of money, or are there different pools that they're based on?
Well, for instance, the loan processing issuance fee is based on the actual amount that is guaranteed, where the maintenance fee is based on how much principal balance is actually outstanding on these loans each year. So the amount that those fees are calculated off of are different pools.
So if you were to take the total volume of dollars that you process in this program and then the total amount of administrative funding that you have available to do that, what's the relationship between the two?
Well, one is the relationship of how much we originally guarantee.
What I'm asking is, if you were to take all of the dollars that you administer in your department and then take all of the administrative revenue that you get to do it with, what's the total percentage of administrative dollars to program dollars?
Madam Chair, I don't have that dollar figure for you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
What's your book of business? How much you got out in loans? I thought I saw $250 million somewhere, but I'm not sure that's correct.
Well, I think what you're referring to is what we guaranteed for the last 2 years, but you want to know what we actually have currently outstanding in loan guarantees.
Business for what you got outstanding that you're watching and monitoring and the loans you're making. Sort of a 40,000 foot look at this thing.
Well,
right. We currently have.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if I might respond to that, we don't have the exact number, but our portfolio is about $900 million of loans in good standing. There is about $90 million in defaulted student loans that we are collecting on. We are guaranteeing about $150 million of new loans a year. And then I don't have a number on the numbers or dollar volumes on the top of my head on the default diversion activities that we're involved in. Does that get to the heart of your question?
We're getting there.
Chair Morgan and Bates.
We're getting there.
Okay.
What I'm curious about is what actually is the percentage of costs that is attributable to administration across the spectrum of the programs. And I realize that you don't have that information with you, but I would appreciate it if you could put some kind of thing together that doesn't cause you to stay up all night doing it.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, just so I can clarify, you would like the relationship of the cost to administer the program in relation to the amount of business that we're doing.
Well, and what I'm real interested in is, based on the percentages that you gave us that you are permitted to pull out to cover administrative costs, what is the what does that end up being in relationship to the total dollars that you're working with?
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I might respond to that generally, it is about one-to-one. And the way that the fund is established, one of the slides we talked about changes in the federal student loan program a number of years ago, they changed the way that we do business. And in essence, it's you get money in for loan program purposes, and you have to have a separate fund to keep track of that and pay expenses out of. And it is about one-to-one relationship. But we can provide you more specific information.
Was there a point in time when these functions were administered by the individual campuses?
Back in 1960, they had what was called the FISL, or FISL, Federal Insured Student Loan Program, and but that was actually administered through Washington, D.C. They do have a Perkins Loan Program that the U.S. Department of Education provides institutions monies to loan out, and they administer those at the institution level, but that is a dwindling pool of money, and it doesn't compare size-wise to the federal student loan program. They're actually, they're not eliminating it, but they're not funding it as robustly as they have in the past, and it's not close to the level of the loans that we guarantee.
So if Oregon didn't have at the state level, a guarantee program and a default program and a maintenance program, what would happen?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that function could go on. And as I indicated earlier when we were talking about the marketing and training positions, we're in a competitive environment. We compete against national guarantors who are located in Indiana, who would do this very thing. The value to Oregon, this is my opinion, is that with the synergy of the dollars that come into this state and allow us to operate this program, allow us also to provide a resource to you in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. We have an HR director who is funded mostly with the loan program funds. 80% of my position is funded by the loan program. You cannot get an executive director operating at FTE of 0.2. So there are some synergies involved in having this combination of income streams coming into this organization, of which if we don't have the loan program, we're not able to do, we can't buy an AS400 just to operate the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program or the private scholarship program. It's the synergy of these income streams that allow us to have the size that we are and provide the services that we do.
Representative Mark.
Let me maybe follow up on that. You mentioned something like national firms that maybe do something along these lines. They probably don't waive the 1% fee to the loan fees. Would that be a correct assumption?
Most do. Excuse me, Madam Chair and Representative Morgan. Most do.
Madam Chair, what does a loan guarantee mean to students? Does that lower their interest rate?
The guarantee itself doesn't necessarily lower the student's interest rate. When you compare the direct program, which is versus the FFELP program, I think is really where you see some differences in borrower benefits. The direct loan program versus the FFELP program. FFELP has a lot of competitive factors in it, and because of those competitive forces, a lot of borrower benefits are to the student's advantage because you have lenders that are competing against each other for the student's business, so that can translate into lower interest rates. to the student. So, and also just in default prevention efforts and resources to the student. So there are, I think, in the FFELP program benefits to the borrower, but it is necessarily isn't tied into the guarantee itself.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, committee, if I might respond to that, having a guarantee does provide lower cost loans to students. And if you take a look at what we view as a typical student, 18-year-old coming out of high school, may have a credit card, probably shouldn't, but doesn't have a credit history, that a lender is going to say, you're a good credit risk. So the guarantee is to lenders that if you loan the Johnnies and the Susies of the world who are coming out of high school thousands of dollars, we will provide you a guarantee that if they default, we're going to pay that loan off. And because of that guarantee, lenders are willing to loan money out. I think the current rate is 5%. You cannot get a private commercial loan out there if you're 18 if you're lucky 18 or 25%. So it does lower the cost of capital to students. Yeah.
But what I thought I also heard you say was that this is a service that's also available in the private sector.
The lenders, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the private sector is providing the loan capital. We're matching it up with a loan guarantee, and those two pieces make the funds available. Without the guarantee, lenders would not be making low-cost loans to students. It's just too risky. They're going to have students default. They're going to lose money. They're going to exit the program, and all of a sudden you see a lack of capital in order to be able for students to finance their education. And at the, we're in the midst of reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which is what these programs are under. And they're looking at the loan limits because right now, they're as a freshman, you can only borrow $2,625. And yet students have this gap, so they are using credit cards to pay that. They're going to alternative loans, alternative student loans that have higher interest rates. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Masterly.
Madam Chair, are there any advantages to the lender in providing these student loans under these programs? Tax advantages, or I'm trying to think what I want to say, it's COA or CNA or something like that for
Madam
high
Chair.
Risk loans?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Masterly, there aren't any tax advantages that I know of, but the reason why lenders get into this business is because they have some requirements for community investments, but also I think more importantly it gains them access to a customer that they're going to hope to have for life. So when they participate in this program, they are hoping that they can secure additional business down the road in their relationship with this individual, whether it's a mortgage or auto or some other type of loan product.
Hold on, Madam Chair. First, just a comment. I know that's right, and you know, whether it's buying a car or whatever, although our customers generally move a lot, but it is a higher risk for someone that does have an education as well. I mean, less of a risk. But the question I wanted to ask you in follow-up, what is the time frame if there is a default before the bank? Does it take a matter of months or a matter of years before the guarantee is paid off?
Well, where the guarantor originally gets involved is once the loan is over 60 days delinquent, we'll receive a request from the lender for assistance. And at that point, we get involved to help the lender and the borrower to help them avoid default. Once the loan is over 270 days delinquent, they can submit a claim to us as the guarantor, and we go through a process of verifying that they followed all due diligence, and it's at that point that we would approve the claim to purchase the loan.
So you're probably talking close to a year then.
That is correct.
We have 4 minutes left, so we need to find a convenient place to break here. Would this be it by any chance?
Would you like me just to, Madam Chair, would you like me to just finish up the detail on the revenue streams, and that would be the end of that section? Okay. aside from the loan processing fees and the maintenance fees, we also get a default aversion fee, which is 1% of the unpaid principal and accrued interest on loans where the lenders have submitted that request for assistance that I've just mentioned when the loan is 60 days or more delinquent. This helps us defray the costs for staff that are working directly with the borrowers and with the lender to educate them on ways to avoid default. We also have, for collection revenues, recoveries of principal, interest, and charges of loan amounts on defaulted student loans. Our retention for every dollar collected is 24%, with the exception of federal offsets and direct loan consolidations. And then we also have reinsurance on defaulted loans. The U.S. Department of Education reimburses the agency for all or a portion of the amount that the agency reimburses as a lender for a claim situation. This is dependent on the type of claim and the date of the loan disbursement. And the reinsurance can range from 95 to 100% of the reimbursed amount.
Questions or comments? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5052. And tomorrow morning, members, we have a substantive bill before us that is a fix to the accrual bill that we passed in the, I believe it was the third special session, that has gotten out of whack because of the economies that were made under the failure of Measure 28 and the rebalance that happened in November to the revenue expectations, the forecast. So we'll be running that bill first thing in the morning in this committee. If people could adjust their schedules to be here at starting time, I will adjust mine to be here at starting time, and we can get this done. This is a fix that is somewhat time sensitive in that we need to get the issue resolved so that the accruals can actually take place in a reasonable way. And we'll have that all explained to us in the morning. And so,
bill number, Madam Chair?
I can't remember the bill number.
I think it's 2052. Call your office.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
If I might ask, we wanted to spend the bulk of tomorrow talking about the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the general funded pieces, which is in the Grants and Scholarship Division. So we have a bit to go through here in the loan program, but I'd like to speed that up. If you have questions, we welcome them. But I do want to spend the majority of the time that we have available tomorrow really talking about the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, because that's where the major decision from a general fund standpoint is going to be for you. So we're going to take a look at our presentation and see what we can do to just speed it up. If we miss some areas and you want us to talk about it, we'd be happy to, but I want to concentrate on that for you.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
And having no further business before this committee, we are adjourned and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.